Amen. Thank you, Jonathan. So let's learn to do what God asks us to do with His help and by His strength, and not cop out so easily by thinking, well, what can I do? What can I do about this? There's no way I can change this. We can, and Jesus expects us to trust Him and to do. Trust and obey. So Luke 9 again is this basis for our studying. And next we're going to notice this account where Jesus asks His disciples who He is. He first asks, who do the multitudes say that I am? The well-known passage is Matthew 16, because we remember of Matthew 16:16, Peter's great confession. 16:18, upon this rock I will build my church. So that's that account in Matthew. Here we are in Luke 9, the same occasion. Verse 18, it came about that while He was praying alone. And by the way, it is Luke, more than any other gospel writer, that tells us these occasions of Jesus praying. Like, go to Matthew's account that I just mentioned. Doesn't mention Him praying first. Luke mentions it. And there's a reason for all the accounts, or all the occasions of Jesus praying, and it being mentioned by Luke, the physician, who emphasized the human nature of Jesus in his account more than the other gospel writers. That was his emphasis, the Son of Man, or the humanity of Jesus. And it's in his humanity, in the days of his flesh, that he offers up prayer. It's his human side that must rely on prayer. And so that should teach us something. If Jesus, the man, relied on prayer to be able to do all that he did, I, the man, you know, you, just the man, must rely on prayer likewise for the strength we need. So he's praying on this occasion too. And because of the significance of it, I'm about to demand of my disciples, when he asks, who am I? I'm about to demand whether they get it or not. They've been with me now so long, do they get who I am? This is a crux. And I'm about to then tell them who this true person I am, what he has to do. I have to go suffer and be killed, which almost makes no sense to their misconceptions. So it was a crucial moment, and he's praying right before it. Then he calls them together. Who do the multitudes say that I am? And this is interesting. He starts with, who do people say that I am? And some say, John the Baptist, meaning come back alive. They know they were two separate individuals while living. But remember earlier in the chapter when Jesus sent out the 12 and they're working these miracles, Herod even thought, they heard, John has risen from the dead, and that's why all these miracles are taking place. John has come back. No, it's not that. It's Jesus giving his disciples the power to do it. Even Herod hears, John is risen, and Herod says, I myself had him put to death. I want to see this one they're talking about. So some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others, one of the prophets of old has risen again. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And there's a lesson right there. We all grow up hearing things about God, about spiritual things, about the Bible, especially those whose parents were Christians. And if I were to ask you, who do Christians say God is? Who is the true God? Who do Christians say Jesus is? What do Christians say the Bible is? And you can repeat these true answers. But we have to get to the point where I myself answer for myself. I believe this. And it's no longer just because of what others may believe. But who do you say that I am? And Peter answered and said, the Christ of God. And he warned them, instructed them not to tell this to anyone. And he goes on further. But before we do that, I want you to notice this. They're failing to grasp the true nature and the true nature of himself. Yes, they they have come to accept he's their Messiah, but they're still thinking their view of the Messiah. That he is to be more of this physical leader, and he's going to restore the physical kingdom to Israel. And he is going to be this like super great Jew among us. And in fact, some got the notion the Messiah would never die. In John chapter 7, we heard that the Messiah remains forever. That's kind of interesting. They thought he wouldn't die. So this is part of their conceptions, and Jesus is plainly going to say, I'm going to have to die. They refuse to accept a clear word of revelation. It's also what this is going to amount to. He tells them, the Son of Man, read verse 22, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and be raised up on the third day. We read all of those terms, and we understand exactly what he means. We say, sure, yeah, and then he goes and he does that, and that. What's the problem? Look ahead in the chapter in verse 44. 44, let these words sink into your ears, for the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. Verse 45, but they did not understand this statement. Isn't there an old, country song, I say old, supposed to be modern in the 70s or 80s. What part of no don't you understand? Remember that? A woman singing, she's trying to say no, I don't love you. What part of no don't you understand? I mean, it's pretty simple, isn't it? But a guy that doesn't want to hear no, doesn't get it. He keeps coming back. And I want to say this, what part of Jesus' statement don't you understand? You know, let's start with the first word, for. I'm being facetious. What don't you understand? I have to be suffered. I have to suffer. And in fact, what he spelled out earlier, be rejected, be killed, be raised the third day. Oh, you can understand all of those words. The disciples could understand all the words. What it means is they could not accept the meaning. They could not accept what it demands because it didn't fit what they already concluded. They're putting more emphasis on what they already think than what Jesus is trying to make them think. And that's a big problem. It's a problem whenever we do that. We've already concluded some things. We already think a certain way. And so that's set to us. And when we hear something different, and especially from the Word, it's like, I don't know what that means. And the approach of some brethren about some statements in Scripture is like, I'm not sure what to do with that. I just go to this passage over here. It plainly says this. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. Well, do you ever become sure of this other? Or surer? But it's often because it doesn't fit our notion that we've already come up with, that we say, I'm just not sure what that's saying. So it says they did not understand. And we today are reading hearing the same words, and we understand it perfectly. The difference is hearts or attitude. The difference is when we've already made up our minds and refuse to learn more and refuse to add to our knowledge. A deeper understanding, a better understanding, additional thoughts that would modify what we had thought. And then with Peter, actually, well, noticing this, at the end of Luke, okay, after his resurrection and he's appeared to his disciples, he's going to call them, oh, foolish men and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. That, you don't want Jesus to say that about you, to say the least. Foolish men, slow of heart. That's a problem. And these were the best men at the time. Do we remain foolish? Do we remain slow to receive revelation and to believe it? Because it has to change our ideas. Peter went so far as to rebuke. Remember, that's Matthew's account. After Jesus had said, I have to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to suffer from those leaders, I'm going to be killed, raised the third day, Peter says, Peter takes him aside. Thanks, Peter, for doing it, you know, in private instead of all, before all of them. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, that this should ever happen to you. Now, he thought he was doing Jesus a great favor. He thought he was being very noble. I'm going to stand up, Jesus, and defend you from being killed. So, there's no way I'm going to let you be killed. He thought he was being noble. And look how blinded he had become to think I'm doing a great noble service to Jesus when exactly you're doing the exact opposite. You're being an adversary. You're serving Satan's purpose. What Peter was doing is ending up being a stumbling block to Jesus, because later we find out Jesus was struggling with having to suffer and be killed. And he'll actually pray in the garden, God, Father, if there's any way, let this cup pass. If there's some way, you know, to still save man, if possible, that's what I'm getting at, explaining the possible situation. If possible, don't let me have to die. So you know he was wrestling with that in his humanity. And here is Peter kind of giving him an out. I'll never let this happen to you. No way should this happen. And I'll defend you. And there's a piece of Jesus that would say, yeah, I'd like for you to be able to do that. Get behind me, though. Get behind me, Satan. And he'll say plainly, you are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. Really, Peter? It's sounding like this is God's interest. Ah, you're going to defend the Messiah. But it's really man's. You know why? Because if you're, again, your notion of the Messiah is about man's interests. You want a great leading man. They want to become by force and make him king. A king with miraculous powers. Wow. Why, we'll whoop those Romans. You know, we'll send them back to Italy. And we'll be our free nation again as we want to be with a king like that. That's serving man's interests. Look how we can get in our misunderstanding and in our lack of faith and when we will not truly receive revelation, we get to where we actually rebuke Jesus, as Peter was doing. We get to where we're a stumbling block to Jesus. And where we deceive ourselves that our own interests are really doing God's things and God's interests. We don't want to be in that blinded situation. Be humble to learn from God. So that's an issue here in Luke chapter 9. And there's a further discredit, you might say, because... And I'm talking about these words which says they did not understand. Verse 45 now. I'm linking these two different paragraphs in the chapter. Both having to do with the Son of Man's purpose to have to suffer. And they did not understand this statement. Okay. We don't jump on them just for that. Why don't you ask? Jesus, what do you mean? We hear your words and we know what that means, but how does that fit God's purpose? And we're preaching the kingdom is about to come. How does that fit the kingdom able to come if you're killed, if the king is killed? And he would have been glad to explain further. They don't even ask. You know, back during in Matthew 13, when he was teaching all those parables on the kingdom, on one of the parables, parable of the tares, he's telling everyone, the multitudes included, and it says, when he came into the house, the disciples come to him and ask him, explain to us that parable of the tares. And he did. So there is no rebuke in asking. So ask God. Or the idea is, have the heart that's willing to ask. What does God mean by this that I'm reading? I haven't always heard it that way. That's not how it's been preached. But I'm reading something here and it sounds different. Explain to us the parable. I don't understand, but God help me. Pray for wisdom, James says. Any man lack wisdom? Pray for wisdom. And God, it says, who gives without, the King James, upbraiding. Upbraiding, I take it, is not just what you do to your hair. Do women upbraid their hair? I think them downbraid it. Upbraid. God gives without chastening or chiding you for asking. for wisdom. And James will say, you do not have because you do not ask. So that's not good. When we don't understand, or when we don't have maybe enough spiritual strength that we ought to, okay, that's one thing. Not to ask is the real root problem behind it. Shame on the disciples for not asking on this occasion. Back here in Luke 9, the whole chapter is full of their failures. In verse 29, and some 8 days after these things, it came about that he took along Peter, John, and James and went up to the mountain to do what? Guess what? And only Luke will say it was to pray. The other accounts will tell us about the great transfiguration. And Luke says he went up to pray again before another crucial moment. I'm going to manifest my glorious side, my God nature. I'm going to manifest my glorious side to them in a visible way where they can get I'm not just a man. And it's Luke that emphasizes verse 29, while he was praying. The appearance of his face became different. His clothing became white and gleaming. And behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses and Elijah, who, appearing in glory, were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Notice, his departure, not his end. Not his end. Not something negative like a defeat, or, like I said, an end, but rather a leaving, a going away, an embarking, the same word they would use to talk about getting on a boat. A departure that he would take place. Really, we're talking about his death, but it's a departure. Verse 32, now Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep, so meaning, after being on the mountain, probably while Jesus is praying, they fall asleep. But now, with this glorious appearance of the three, they're awakened and this brightness before them. And they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. Mark, look at Mark's account. Mark chapter 6. Excuse me, 9. Mark 9. Verse 6 says, when they're awakened and they're startled by what they're seeing, verse 6 says, for they did not know what to answer, for they had become terrified. And yes, every one of us would have also. Moses and Elijah appearing, you know, they've been dead for centuries, and you're seeing them. And Jesus transformed, shining brightly. They were terrified, and I like this, they did not know what to answer. What do you do in situations where you don't know what to answer? What do you do? What should you do? You know what you should do when you don't know what to say, truly? Don't say anything! But is that what we do? No, tell me. We don't learn. Even when we don't know what to say, we say something. And what do you end up doing? You say something stupid. You say something wrong. Just don't say anything. Or be humble enough to say, I don't know. I don't know. But in a situation like this, it's not calling for an actual answer, okay? So just don't say anything. Can we learn? Peter speaks up as he is, as we've learned, right? He's accustomed to do. We call him impetuous Peter. And really, to his credit, he's willing to speak when others hide in their silence. He may not always get it right when he says and speaks up, but you have to give him credit at times for speaking when others remain silent. But to his discredit, he'll speak when he should just remain silent, not knowing what to say. Okay, don't say anything. But what he says is not right. It's very wrong. And Luke's going to comment on it. What he says, when he's really impressed with this, he says, verse 33, Master, it is good for us to be here. Yeah, that part's good. It sure is. This is an amazing revelation of who Jesus is. Then he says, And let us make three tabernacles, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And then Luke adds, not realizing what he was saying. Ooh, that didn't sound good. I thought what he said sounds good. Sounds very honorable and noble. Let's build three tabernacles. And that just means booths. Doesn't mean holy shrines. You're not saying a holy shrine, you know, as a place to worship each of you three. No, just a booth. Just like out of common hospitality, common decency. Let's make three booths for you. Maybe a shelter from the sun. So at most, that's all we can make of what the booth idea was. You don't have to read religious kinds of shrine into it, as it were. Just the fact, though, that he is honoring all three on the same level. That's what he didn't realize. So again, do we realize what Jesus had? They failed to comprehend his preeminence over all. The preeminence among these others who are also great men of renown, Moses, the lawgiver, Elijah, the great prophet and miracle worker during the period of the kings. And they had great respect for these two men, and you should hold such in high esteem, but not the same esteem as Jesus. But that's what his comment had done, put them all three on the same level, instead of recognizing, no, Jesus belongs in a class by himself. If anything, let me build a booth for you, Jesus. Period. Let's build a booth for you. You deserve this. You are totally different than these other two. Understandably impressed, and mind-boggled, as we would have been also. But they failed to still grasp who Jesus really was. The preeminence of Jesus is going to be demonstrated two ways by them. First of all, by the actual physical circumstance. Verse 34 says, and while he was saying this, so like still at the tail end of speaking about this, a cloud formed and began to overshadow them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. Think about a fog suddenly descending on you. And afraid. It's kind of like this feeling of, uh-oh. And if I were Peter, it's like, did I say something wrong? I'm not making light of this. They're getting this chilling feeling like, ooh. What's about to happen? Well, it's in response to what Peter had said and what that implies. And it's not just Peter alone who doesn't get it, who Jesus is. And God the Father is about to make it clear. So again, this is Luke's little detail about this cloud forming. And they're going, oh, this isn't just a natural weather situation. And then a voice comes out of the cloud saying, this is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. One of the other accounts says, and while the other two were departing. So while they were fading, it's kind of like the picture. While they're fading, Jesus stands out alone. And then a voice out of heaven. So both, like I said, by voice and by view. The cloud and the point that these other two, as they are leaving, as they are fading away. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. See that impression? Listen to him. Which is also a declaration, because they had been listening, and even currently were listening to whom? Moses and the prophets, who backed up the preaching of the law. And we're reminding the people, you need to get back to the law. You need to remember the law. Moses gave it. The prophets reinforced it. That's who they had been listening to currently. And now they're to learn the lesson. We're to listen to Jesus. May we learn that lesson also and be impressed with the preeminence of Jesus. For our help, let me turn to Colossians, for your help, Colossians 2. When I think about the preeminence of Jesus and our impression with him, I think of Colossians 1 and 2. Paul calls him the firstborn of the dead, the preeminent one, not literally firstborn in any sense of the word, but what firstborn connotes, the most important. So he's called the firstborn of all creation, verse Colossians 1:15. Firstborn of all creation. And then verse 18, he's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, the preeminent of those who have died. By the way, he wasn't the first one resurrected. That's not what that means. Firstborn from the dead doesn't mean first one to be resurrected. Again, Elijah resurrected a boy. Elisha resurrected a boy. Jesus resurrected Lazarus. He wasn't the first one to be resurrected, but he was first place of all who have died, so that he himself might come to have first place in everything. And in chapter 2 and in verse 3, in whom, Jesus, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And verse 9, for in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him you have been made complete. That's what I wanted to emphasize. You need to see his preeminence, so that being that knowing Christ and being in this right relationship with him makes you complete. Back in Luke 9. The next day, and on the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, I think that's important, they had just seen the glory of Jesus and just been impressed with who he was, greater than Moses and Elijah. And they just heard the Father's voice out of heaven. This is my son. Listen to him. The very next day, Jesus, who has given them power ever since earlier in the chapter when he sent them out, gave them authority over demons, chapter 9, verse 1, authority over all the demons, and to heal diseases, proclaim the kingdom. Behold, a man from the multitude shouted out, saying, "Teacher, I beg you, look at my son, for it is my only boy, and behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams and throws him into a convulsion and foaming at the mouth, and as it mauls him, it scarcely leaves him, and I beg your disciples to cast it out." Probably a reference to earlier in the chapter, back when they were traveling among the cities. "And I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they could not." And we read that and say, well, of course they couldn't. Something that scary. A demon that strong, powerful, and makes the person so crazy. We would have run from that too. I'm not sure why I have this next. Let me see if I've got this in the right order. Failure to accomplish this task that he had given them of casting out demons. So even though the man says, "and they could not," we're pointing out, no, the real point is that they would not. It had to do with their will and their effort. And Jesus explains why also. You can see a tone of frustration in his voice. Verse 41, you don't want to frustrate Jesus. "Oh, unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you?" At first it sounds like he's rebuking his father, but he's not. The father believes Jesus has this power. And Jesus' disciples should also, you know, he believes. It's not his lack of faith. He brings them to the disciples. Now he brings them to Jesus. That's amazing faith. Even when the first attempt failed, and he brings them to Jesus. He believes. Jesus is not rebuking him. "Oh, unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Jesus is rebuking that whole generation, notice, of which his disciples were a product. That's why they are unbelieving. They're the product of their generation, okay, but he expects them to grow out of it. We're the products of our culture, and we are affected by it, and its way of thinking. We are. It would help us to own up to that, to be aware of it, and then to realize, and Jesus expects us to grow beyond it, and grow out of just that way of thinking. Verse 42, "Bring your son here." While he was still approaching, the demon dashed him to the ground, threw him into a convulsion. You can hear the disciples saying, "See, Jesus? See? See how this was? We couldn't do anything about something like that." But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to the father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. Turn to Matthew's account, Matthew chapter 17, the very same account. Contains this key statement of Jesus that explains the problem. The problem was not, this was a super bad demon that only Jesus could handle. That was not it. And in fact, one of the other gospel accounts, Matthew has it here, and in my translation, it has it in brackets, because it's not in what's considered the most reliable manuscript, or the most authenticated. The statement in verse 21, "But this kind," you know, this is so bad of a demon, "this kind only goes out except by prayer and fasting." Maybe. You know, I'm not a textual a scholar that would be expert in saying what actually was authentic or not. Maybe that's the case. But we do know this is truly the case. Verse 20. Verse 19, they come to him privately after that, you see, and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "Because of the littleness of your faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you." Really, that is enough, really, of an answer to deal with that situation. Because of the littleness of your faith. We all know that response about faith of a mustard seed to move mountains. A promise again given to the apostles, not just every Christian. We know that response. It was based on this situation. They couldn't cast out this certain demon. Why? You know why? Really, are some demons more powerful than others? You know, they're all given the power from the same source of Satan. Was that really what made the difference? No. What made the difference is what they saw with their eyes. Throwing them into convulsion, foaming at the mouth, dashing them to the ground. Oh! So, we become moved by what we visibly see, and somehow that's affecting our faith in a matter. Yeah, own up to that. Sometimes we are. Sometimes some problems look too big. The person is too outspoken, too powerful, too demanding, too strong-willed. Oh, can't deal with that problem person, you see, because that's just too messy. No, it's the littleness of our faith. And we're being too affected by the visual presentation of the situation or the problem. And again, that's for all of us to have to apply and to work through. We let the looks of something appear too big to handle. And so we don't handle it with God again, with God's help, or with faith in God, trusting God. God says, "I'm to do right in this matter. I'm to say what's right. I'm to speak what's right in this situation. I'm to rebuke or reprove. I'm to stand. I'm to hold fast to this course, not be swayed, not to give in. Not to be pressured by," and sometimes it looks too big, but it's a matter of we're not being faithful, we're not acting by faith, because of the littleness of your faith. And what if truly this verse belongs here? "This kind only goes out except by prayer and fasting. Kind of sounds like a really different kind of solution than what Jesus gave. Littleness of faith. But say it were the solution, then did you disciples think about fasting and praying? No. You're just thrown off by the visual and said, "We can't do this." Well, then why didn't you fast and pray? You see, those were not new concepts to them either. They were not using faith. They were using, again, what they thought their own physical power. And they failed again. I'd like to, well, we know. We know they learned from it afterwards. Back here in Luke 9. While all the people are marveling, verse 43, marveling at this latest miracle, casting out such a demon with those effects, marveling at the greatness of God, everyone was marveling about all he's doing. I like the contrast. Contrast that stands out. What a great person this is, who Jesus is. And he says, but believe it or not, I have to be killed. I have to suffer by your very religious leaders. The best religious people among you want me dead. Really? And they can't believe it. Verse 46, immediately after Jesus telling what he has to suffer himself, he finds his disciples engaged in a selfish debate. Jesus has just described his selflessness, and his very followers are discussing which one among them is the greatest. And an argument arose among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking, so notice, he didn't overhear their conversation. And they know he didn't walk in, and they're still talking about who's greatest, and he's hearing this. He just knows what they're thinking. And then here in a moment, they're going to know that he knows what we were thinking, not what we were saying. Ooh, he knew what we were discussing, and he uses this object lesson of taking a child. It's a lack of humility and the serving spirit on their part, of course. So Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child and stood him by his side. The same kind of a person whom the disciples earlier thought don't count. Remember, children don't count. They were bringing their children to Jesus that he might lay his hands on them, and the disciples were trying to prevent it. They were like shooing away. Look, Jesus is a great adult. We're great adults. He doesn't have time for children. Children don't count. They're little nobodies. You know, what kind of force do they have? How big are their muscles? How outspoken are they? How demanding can they be to make changes? They don't count in the disciples' book. Jesus stands one of those, little child in their midst, and says, whoever receives this child in my name receives me. Whoever receives me receives him who sent me. The idea there again, they were not into receiving children. Children were beneath their dignity. Don't count. They're not great somebodies like I'm great. I receive, his point is, you receive who you think you are. You receive the type of person you think you are. When you're great, you invite great guests. Guests of only nobility, you know, and of the upper classes. That's who you invite. Like Jesus taught on another occasion. Go out into the hedges and the highways. Invite the poor. Invite those that can't pay you back, that can't invite you back. Be doing that. No, we receive those of our like view of myself. Well, if you receive a child, he's saying, you're receiving me. And that's a new lesson and a tough lesson for the disciples. For he who is least among you, this is the one who is great. This isn't the only occasion we find them debating who's greatest among them. It's pitiful. On another occasion, James and John are trying to beat the other disciples to the punch, or beat them to the opportunity. And they actually get their mother to go ask Jesus, request that when you come in your kingdom, these two sons of mine, James and John, sit one on your right, one on your left. The greatest places in the kingdom. And not only were those two to blame for that desire, but the other 10 were to blame, because it says, and the other 10 became indignant at them. Like jealous, or like, I can't believe they got to him first. And you don't become indignant unless you're thinking the same way. What you do, you say, oh, pitiful, those two pitiful disciples. I can't. Pitiful that they're seeking that. They don't get it. I get it, but they don't. You don't become indignant unless you're jealous of that and you wanted the same. They were they were all coming from. A prevalent way of thinking based on the flesh, of seeking your own position first and elevating self. And Jesus, as we know, by his own lifestyle and teaching, taught, no, you give of yourself, and God will reward that later. You give, you serve, you put the needs of others first, and God will see to it that you are rewarded in due time. Verse 49, a very interesting episode. And John answered and said, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to hinder him because he does not follow along with us. I'm pretty sure John was expecting a pat on the back. Way to go. Way to go, John. Yeah, you get him. I'm sure he was expecting a commendation of some sort. Jesus, like, at least saying, well, thank you. Glad you did that. Jesus says, do not hinder him. What? The exact opposite of what John says. We tried to hinder him. Do not hinder him. For he who is not against you is for you. And what we have here, in the same idea of promoting self, is a sectarian spirit. He does not follow along with us was the only basis that John was going on. He doesn't belong to our very number, who are physically following you, Jesus, you know, as you move about city to city. We're physically with you and staying with you. He's not in this group of ours. But Jesus is basically saying, but John, what is he doing? Not just where does he belong? What is he doing or not doing? Well, let's see that again. Master, we saw someone casting out demons. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? In your name. Is that a good name or a bad name? That's a good name. Now, John, had you saw someone instilling demons? I don't know that men actually did that. Well, we don't read of that. Hey, did you see him instilling a demon? Yeah, stop him. Or was he casting out a demon in someone else's name? In the name of Beelzebul. Or in the name of some foreign god, some idol. Had he been doing that, John, you'd been right to have hindered him. Casting out demons in your name, but the only basis was, he's not a part of our unique group that physically, you know, is physically together and on a daily basis moving, staying, eating together. Sorry. That's a wrong basis. It's the basis of truth, what someone is actually doing or not doing, teaching or not teaching. And like Jesus says, he's not against you. There's only two camps. If he's not against you, he's for you. But I don't like the way it looks. He looks different, maybe. A different look. I don't care. What's he doing? Not doing. Teaching. Not teaching. They've got different customs. Okay? Is it truth or error? It doesn't look like us. It's not like we do it. And so that's hard for us to learn sometimes too. We are easily swayed by, well, brethren should look this way, but they should do the same things the very same way, have a certain look, certain phrases. You got to speak of something the very same way. You got to use the same term versus another term. And we're learning from this just little brief account what the proper basis needs to be. Do not hinder him. He who is not against you is for you. And then this last episode of their failure. Fear to have compassion on their enemies. Verse 51. Came about when the days were approaching for his ascension. That doesn't mean back to heaven, right? You remember? It means his going up in elevation, physically, to Jerusalem. Everything else around it, Galilee, even though we say up north, it was down north, down in elevation. It's time for him to start climbing to Jerusalem. So he's in the north, and he's going to go through Samaria. Samaria is between Galilee and Judea. That he resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead of him, and they went, entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him, and they did not receive him because he was journeying with his face toward Jerusalem. So the Samaritans were just as prejudiced against their fellow Jews as the Jews were against them. Well, doesn't make it right on either account. Nope, he can't stay in this village if he's on his way to Jerusalem. We have nothing to do with Jerusalem. And if that's his purpose and goal, he's not welcome here. And the disciples should have said, fine, you're the losers. You're losing out by not having Jesus among you. Fine, we'll find somewhere else. No, they respond in kind, with the same kind of prejudice. So since they wouldn't receive Jesus, it says, verse 54, and when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, Lord, you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Obviously thinking that is the appropriate response to them, to their inhospitality. You want us to command fire. And he turned and rebuked them. And again, another passage of scripture that is debated whether how authentic it is based on the manuscripts. It does fit the teachings of Jesus elsewhere. It is consistent. And he said, you do not know what kind of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And Jesus said something just like that. If not here in this account, he said that in Matthew 20, and also in Mark chapter 10, the purpose of Jesus coming to save men's life and not to be served, but to serve and to even give his life a ransom for all. You do not know of what kind of spirit you are, how true that is. You still have a carnal spirit. You haven't learned the spirit of Jesus, who had compassion on the lost, who said, pray for your enemies. Do good to those who spite you. Bless those who curse you. And here's that very application. This is a curse, as it were. They're cursing you. Do not stay here. Bless them. Say, thank you anyway. Thank you anyway. We'll go elsewhere. And that's what Jesus ends up doing at the end of verse 56. And they went to another village. It's as simple as that. You don't have to call down fire on everyone you see who opposes what you're about, everyone who doesn't agree with you, and you get all bent out of shape, even the application of road rage. So let them go in front of you. Let them pass you. He stays on your bumper, trying to pass, and he passes, and immediately you both stop at the same light, and you say, So what did you gain? You know, you couldn't wait to pass me, you know. And here we are, both sitting for 3 minutes. Okay. And our point is to learn. So what's the big deal? They went on to another village. They found a place to stay. It's only because of our heart that we will view others to this degree. Now, yes, it's not just any others. It's our enemies. It's those who stand opposed to us, that do not welcome, that do not approve and sanction and help us. Then you should feel sorry for them and say, I hope someday you learn God and you learn God's way for you. And I don't want to take away this opportunity by having you killed right now on the spot. I want to give you time to come to the knowledge of the truth or to come to repentance. Those are two passages that talk about God's patience giving men those opportunities. Come to the knowledge of the truth. Come to repentance. I hope that our review of their failures has helped us face our own, or at least our weaknesses, as disciples and continue to grow. They did. We already noted that just briefly in the book of Acts. They did. Will we? And that's our task. Thank you, brethren, for considering these, again, these well-known accounts. I want to thank the disciples, if I could, for allowing themselves to be these object lessons. You see, they're glad to, because they've changed and they've learned better. And they would say gladly, if you can learn from our mistakes, great. We're glad that you do. Let's be doing just that. Again, I appreciate the opportunity.